My name is Cynthia, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Joe will read the preamble.
Joe, alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. David will read the steps.
Hi, my name is David. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and a power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jimmy will read the traditions.
Good evening, my name is Jimmy Noonan, I'm an alcoholic. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group would never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name would never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. And our first 10-minute speaker is Mandy.
I'm Mandy. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mandy.
I'm grateful to be speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to be speaking here. Spoke here once a few years ago, and I thought that I would never, ever get asked to speak here again, and I was proven wrong. My sobriety date is December 18th, 2002. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I have sponsees. My home group is Youth Enjoying Sobriety, and I grew up here on the Upper East Side, and grew up in a privileged home, went to private school my whole life, and I always felt like I never fit in. My hair was too curly, I was too short, like I had braces when I was like 13, like I never felt like I really fit in, you know? So when everyone else on the weekends, on Saturdays and Friday nights, were going to people's houses and drinking, it was like the thing to do, you know? It's like all the older kids are doing it, so I might as well do it. I remember the first time I took a drink with my friends, I had this beer, I think it was like an Amstel Light or something. And I remember in the movies how when cowboys would like take a slug back and then throw the beer down, and they did it like flawlessly, you know? So I wanted to drink just like them, and I wanted to put on a show for everybody, you know? I'll show you guys how to drink, you know? Here I am like 14 years old. So I take this beer and I take off the top and I slug it back and I drink it and I pull it down. And I didn't realize that like beer has some carbonation in it. So it fizzes all over me, you know? And I'm so embarrassed. I threw the bottle into the garbage can and I cracked it. And I was humiliated for the rest of the night. It took me like a few weeks or so to learn how to drink, you know, Zimas, Colt 45s, you know, it was like any kind of flavored alcohol in the beginning that I can get my hands on, because we were 15 years old drinking, like we couldn't go to the bars, so we got fake IDs, and then we would go and get beer, we'd ask older people to get us beer, you know, that was how we drank, or we'd raid our parents' liquor cabinets. By the time I was about 17 or 18 years old, I started to like look at my parents and get into fights with them. I started to be late for curfew every night. I started to lie. My grades slipped in school. And every day I'd be in class and I couldn't wait for the weekends. I couldn't wait to go to 86th Street and East End to that park, or go to Stuytown or go to Central Park and drink with my friends. Or if we're lucky, our parents were out of town and we can go and get drunk in our parents' houses, you know, and raid their liquor cabinets. And I just couldn't wait for that, because every time I took that drink, I secretly had this fantasy that every girl in the room was jealous of me, and every guy secretly had a crush on me, you know? And that's what alcohol did to me. It made me feel like I fit in. You know, it took away all that insecurity about the curly hair and being short. It took it all away, and it made me feel like I belonged. By the time I was 18, I was going to school up on 77th and Lexington, the small school, and I was applying to colleges, and I decided the only college I wanted to go to was in Florida or California so I could stay tan all year long. And that was my primary purpose for college. Forget the academics. It was just staying tan, you know? That's it. I want to party, I want to look good, and that's it, you know? Meanwhile, I'm wearing designer jeans that haven't been washed. My hair hasn't been washed, and I vomit on my clothes, and I think I look good. You know, I think I look hot, and I didn't. I was sick. I was emancipated. I would walk across the street and the sunlight would hurt me because I was so weak, you know? That's how weak I got. And every day I would tell myself, I'd wake up and I'd say, I'm not going to do it today. I'm not going to get drunk today. And here I am every day. I'm going and I'm doing it. And I can't figure out why. I went into treatment in December 18, 2002. I put myself into treatment. And I was 18 years old. And I walked into the treatment facility with drugs in my pocket. Can only say that. So, and I was caught. I was sober the whole time, went to meetings, but I kept them hidden in the bottom of my closet in case I ever had a feeling. They found them one night. They kicked me out. they sent me up to Connecticut, where they had these goats up on this in this treatment facility. And here I am, a city girl, and they have goats, you know? Like, we don't do that stuff, you know? And they're asking us to wash dishes and, like, clean our rooms. Like, I don't do that stuff. I hire people to do that stuff. And I walked in with this very entitlement attitude, you know, this attitude that I think I know how everybody else should live their lives. I thought everyone else was crazy. I remember I was in this treatment facility in my first few weeks, and I pointed the finger at the professionals, and I said, how do we know that you guys aren't the crazy ones? You know, how do I know that I'm the crazy one? Because I just didn't get it. I didn't get that alcohol was my problem. You know, it wasn't my problem. It was my solution, and I didn't get that. I didn't get that I had a problem in my mind, that I had an allergy, you know, or a disease. I didn't get it. We didn't understand that stuff growing up on the Upper East Side. We weren't taught about alcoholism, you know. I remember one day in this treatment facility, they were taking us to meetings in Southbury every Wednesday night, and this was a Friday night, and everyone was, or Friday during the day, and everyone was outside touching these goats and picking up firewood, which is called kindling out in Connecticut. And I went inside and I called my mom and I said, I can't do this anymore. Pick me up. I want to go home. These people hate me. And that day she said to me, Mandy, why don't you just go home and apologize? And for some reason, I went downstairs and I apologized. And the next day, I was able to wash dishes and pick up sticks and clean these goat pens. And that was my spiritual experience. That was my change in my outlook upon life. I suddenly lost that entitlement and I became willing, you know? I got my 6-month coin, I came back to New York, I found the 79th Street workshop, the 10 p.m. meeting, I went around to the meetings for a few weeks, and I got a sponsor here, and I switched sponsors, and then I switched sponsors again, and eventually I finished my fourth step, you know, and I didn't really feel my first step until about 3.5 years sober, to be honest, you know. I understood that I had some kind of a problem, but to really feel that I was an alcoholic, that alcohol is the solution to my problems, I didn't feel it until I hit some bottoms in AA with my dad having a heart attack and my best friend getting cancer. I didn't realize that I reached for other things for my solution, you know? But I got connected with young people's meetings. It's where I feel like I belong. I started to pray on a daily basis. I have a higher power that I talk to every day. And I walk around today with this presence of God in my chest. You know, it's just this feeling that I'm safe, you know, that like whatever happens, no matter how nervous I am right now, I'm safe, you know. I'm not going to drink today. I know that. I've done all 12 steps. I've studied the traditions. I've started an AA meeting. Like, I've done all that stuff. What I found is really important for my sobriety is to feel this program and embrace it and then show it to other people, show them how I've recovered or how I carry the message on a daily basis, you know. Because all I am is an alcoholic with my experience to share to somebody else. Like, I don't have it. I used to have a holier-than-thou attitude about my recovery, about how I used to preach these principles, and now I feel like I have to walk it before I preach it, you know? I have to really feel it more than just understand it. It says in our literature that our thinking is our problem, and I really understand that now. I really feel it now, that my thinking is my problem. So when I'm in my head too much, some of the tools that I learned is to pick up the phone and call my sponsor, call another alcoholic, make it to a meeting. One of my first sponsors, Sue P., from this meeting, she told me to hit my knees. So that's something I can reach out and do whenever I want. I can hit my knees and say a prayer. And today, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. My dreams were to be on page 6, to have a sugar daddy, and secretly be a go-go dancer, you know. Today, right now, tomorrow, I'm giving my senior thesis presentation. I'm 23 years old. Like, I have my own apartment. I have these people in my life that are like my lifelines. They're my friends. They're the family that I never felt like I had growing up in my home, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous will give you that. You know, it'll give you those friends. It'll give you that sense of comfort and ease that you looked for in the bottle, you know. And that is such a miracle that I can say that I don't have to drink today. Like, I couldn't say that before I found these rooms, you know? And it's not as rigid and not so tough as everyone says it is, you know? I find that the people in these rooms are very gentle because they're alcoholics too, you know? And that's how I know that I'm safe, you know? That's how I know that I can identify with these people because we're all alcoholics, you know? So I have a minute left, and I just went blank. So I want to say again that I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful for the people in my life. And if I can do it, anybody can do it. So thanks.
Awesome. Our second 10-minute speaker is John.
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 21st, 2003. My sponsor is Kevin H. My home group is the Atlantic Group. And I'm currently revisiting step two. Boy, am I revisiting step two. I'm grateful to God that that I didn't drink today, that I don't feel like drinking, and have not found it necessary to drink for the past 1,410 days. Thanks. this really reminds me of when I was a freshman at this the second college that I attended, which was a little liberal arts joint in northern Indiana, and I was taking a speech class, and I was really, really bombing every speech that I made, and was getting like C minuses and D's and things like that. An upperclassman who'd had the class suggested I drink half a pint of whiskey before my next speech, which I did. And it was a demonstration. I was really on. I had people jumping out of their seats, and I got a B for the speech. And then the next day, the cute hippie chick that sat next to me in class, I ran to her on campus and said, "I'm hitchhiking down to Bloomington this afternoon, and would you like to come with me?" And she said, "Yes." And we hitched the 150 miles to the campus of this giant university and went party hopping all evening. And she and I wound up in a friend's dorm room that night. And that night I became a man. And I found that liquor proved positive that liquor would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I'm the eldest of three children. I grew up in northern Indiana outside of Fort Wayne. It's 100% old German American Midwestern stock. There's no other alcoholics in my family, and alcoholism is not in my family tree. Most everyone in my family is dedicated to some form of service, politically or military, education, community service, agriculture. They're not flashy people. They're no-nonsense people. I, on the other hand, am a nonsense person. I managed to extend my adolescence from age 15 for the better part of three decades and to the threshold of middle age. And I have managed to party with some of the more noteworthy hedonists of the past half century. The first time I got drunk was in a tent in our lower pasture, on a camp out with some friends of mine who I'd been trying to impress and trying to hang out with since eighth grade. I was a sophomore in high school at the time, and they'd shunned me until I invited them to this camp out. And the first thing we pitched was the drinking tent, and produced our little bottles of Southern Comfort and Slow Gin and any Green Springs with some cans of Schlitz and Stroh's. And proceeded to get trashed. We also proceeded to bond, and we were near a road, and during the course of the evening, we were visited by carloads of kids, like a Nova full of girls. Some of them were cheerleaders, a charger full of potheads, and some gearheads came by and laid rubber as sort of a salute. Wow, that was quick. Anyway, I continued on like this till I was 43 years old. My bottom was sort of like a Wile E. Coyote cartoon where he goes off the cliff and realizes that there's no ground beneath him and then, you know, crashes through trees and rocks and, you know, all, and does that for, you know, 28 years. What got me to a meeting was that I'd given up a lot in life. That at one point I came to New York to go to film school. I gave that up. I gave up a lot of things. I gave up my relationship with my family. I gave up a lot of job prospects. Gave up educational prospects, all for the sake of partying. I wound up getting involved in the club scene in the mid-80s. And, you know, I was in Page Six, and I did have a sugar mama. That seemed very validating for a while. Rather than directing films, I wound up being a roadie and living by the roadie's credo, which I don't have time to get into tonight. I did work down at the World Trade Center, and as a result of that, was suffering from symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome, and was married at the time, and my marriage was falling apart. I went for marriage counseling. My wife didn't show up, and my therapist, whose name was Grace, coincidentally enough, said, you know, we got to work on you. And she gave me a number for another 12-step program, which I attended for a while. But they suggested that if I couldn't make their meetings, to come to AA. The other thing was that I didn't quite understand that that programs of total sobriety meant that I couldn't be going out after a meeting and having a few beers, which to me, it really amounted to several gallons of beer. Anyway, a friend of mine, when I came to these doors, the one fact of life was that I was bereft. I was miserable. I didn't really like meetings, but I never did. I didn't like going to 4-H meetings. I hated Cub Scout meetings. And AA meetings were sort of the same, but somebody very early on said, you know, give it a try. If you don't like it, you can always go back to being miserable. So, you know, that sort of opened the door for me. Other suggestions that I got early on were, you know, if you went all over town to get trashed, go all over town to get sober. So I go all over town. I wound up at the doors of this meeting about 10 days sober and talked to a gentleman named Michael Belli, who, you know, I was still trying to figure out. I actually was going to AA to hopefully get kicked out so I could go drink again. People have someone say, well, your problem's not alcohol. He made the suggestion that, look, you started with alcohol, now's your opportunity to end with alcohol. And, time to milk the cows. Anyway, well, now, for me right now, it's the question of my life is, how can I get this program better? How can I strengthen and get closer to God? I really appreciate the opportunity for the steps, for the meetings, the suggestions I hear. appreciate all of you for helping keep me sober. I'd like to thank my first sponsor, Paul, my present sponsor, Kevin, and thank you all for being here and listening.
For support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. Our main speaker tonight is Tracy.
Good evening. My name is Tracy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Woo, this is a big meeting. I am from Long Beach, New York, out on Long Island. All right. My home group is Serenity by the Sea. I celebrated 10 years on March 17th of this year, on St. Patty's Day, yeah. My story, oh God. I was born and raised in Point Lookout, right next to Long Beach, out on Long Island. And as a child, I grew up in a really great family. It was a beach town, and it was just a fun town to grow up in as a kid. I had a younger sister, and she and I, we just had a blast. And I had an older brother, but he was 10 years older, so we didn't hang out too much. But I grew up, and we had a lot of fun and felt very safe. It was a small community of 11 by 4 blocks, and it was a peninsula. So you came into town, you either weren't leaving or you didn't belong there. And it was just a beach town, and I was swimming before I was walking, and that whole community was happening, and I had a blast. I had a real good time. My parents kept building our house. It was a small little beach bungalow, and they kept enlarging it and making it bigger and bigger so that they could entertain. My father was the vice president of a magazine here in Manhattan. He was the vice president of advertising, and his company was getting bigger, and he was getting bigger, and they were having parties at the house. And my sister and I learned how to clean up the parties, and at the end of them, we would get everybody's drinks, take them to the kitchen, and they'd just all refresh them. My mother had this bar going on in the house that was built into the wall, and my sister and I learned how to drink at a very young age by drinking the bottoms of these drinks. And it was just a way of life. My mother threw a lot of parties, and Point Lookout was a very party city. You walked out your door, and two doors to the right was a bar, and right around the corner was a bar, and three doors down to the street was a bar. And I just grew up in that environment of partying. Everybody partied. In the summertime, all the kids got together, went to the beach, hung out. There was a crowd of 17-year-olds over there and 5-year-olds over there and 20-year-olds over there, and everybody had their group. And as you got older, the coolers got bigger, and of course the coolers got filled with more than juice and soda after a while. And it wasn't, back then nobody stopped you from bringing alcohol, beer, wine, anything to the beach, so we had a lot of fun, and nobody stopped us. And at a very young age, we were drinking, and we didn't go to the bars yet. And I was in the bar way before I was 18, which is dating myself, and that was the drinking age back then. But we would go from house to house, partying, just drinking and partying and partying. And, you know, I didn't like the taste of alcohol, but I wanted to fit in. And I knew I didn't feel like I fit in if I didn't do what everybody else was doing, and that was drinking and just doing what everybody else did. And for a long time, I didn't want to, but I found myself partying and partying. But I would drink one sip of beer and flip the rest of it over my shoulder and then pretend that I was blasted and get away with it for a long time, because I really didn't like being drunk, because I wanted to know what was going on all the time. I had no clue what was going on, but that was the way I was drinking. And then slowly but surely, I started enjoying the drink, and I started getting the buzz, and then I started feeling that good feeling, and I started loving the flavor. And I kept drinking like that for a while and hiding it from my parents. And then I was about 15, 16, maybe 17. My parents knew that we were drinking, my sister and I, and they allowed it. They allowed us to drink with them at the dinner table. So there was no, you know, just don't drink out there. So we could drink and smoke cigarettes with them at the table. So we had arrived, and it proceeded to get worse, but I didn't see it, you know. At first, I saw my parents progressively getting more distant from us, and I didn't think about it, and I didn't pay attention to it. My sister didn't. They started to separate, and I didn't know why. My father's business was getting bigger. He was doing longer trips, and he used to grab us and take us all over the world with him on some of his international trips, but I didn't, you know, I was just a little kid. I just kept going and going, and I was so into myself, I didn't see what was happening around me, and I didn't see all the isms that were starting to develop. I just didn't know I was a spoiled brat. I didn't know that the world didn't revolve around me and the world wasn't my oyster, but I thought it was when I was young. And my mom once said to me, she said, "Do you know what spoiled means?" And I said, "No, I have no clue." And she smacked me across the face into the, you know, I had no idea what was going on. And she proceeded to try and tell me, but from then on, I was a little angry at her. She didn't explain to me what was going on, and I didn't feel any support. She would just yell at me, smack me, and then walk away. And I never felt the love afterwards, you know, and, you know, life continued, and I went out. I went out into the world, and I started hanging with my friends and drinking and partying. And then as I got older, my mother taught me how to run away from situations. She would smack me across the face and leave and go to her room, smack the door, close the door. We wouldn't see her for a while, you know, or wondering what's going on. And I learned how to do that. I learned how to run away from situations and problems just from watching her. I didn't know that until I got sober. And decided that, well, at 17, I was about to go off to college, and my father pulled me aside. We had just come home from dinner, and he said to me, "Well, what would you do if I didn't come home?" And I didn't understand what he meant. And he said, "What would you do if I didn't come back here?" And I go, "What are you talking about?" And he goes, "Your mom and I are splitting up." And I felt like the rug was pulled from under me because I didn't understand. I didn't see it. I didn't see what was the dynamics that were happening in the house. And with that, he drove away. And I didn't get a chance to really understand it or talk to him about it. And he just left. And then they started a divorce pattern, and I didn't see my world falling apart yet, because my mother taught me how to survive. She taught me the survival techniques, you know, how to set the table as if the queen was coming, you know, where all the forks, all the knives, all the spoons, all the glasses, you know, all the etiquettes and the manners. But she didn't teach me how to survive in the world. And she taught me how to put a superwoman coat on, though, and get through anything. And I proceeded to go out into the world and think that I knew what I was doing. But when I was supposed to go to college and my father just left, I didn't know that you could get grants, loans. You know, there was support out there. And I thought I'd get back at my parents and not go to college. And I had learned how to work as a waitress when I was 15, 16, so I'd make a lot of money. And then I was into surfing and body surfing. I would go where the ocean was. Far, far, far away, though. And I would go to Puerto Rico and hang out there for a couple of years, and then go to California and hang out there for a couple of years, and on and on. And then I'd come home, and I'd just keep waitressing, and my mother would go, "Aren't you going to do something?" And I went, "I am. I'm traveling all over the world. I'm meeting new people." That's how I felt I was going to grow up. And then I got a job at the airlines, which was perfect for running away. You know, it was an international airline. And I learned how to travel all over the world, only I was getting paid for it, and party all over the world now. And that was great. It was perfect. I don't remember half of the world that I traveled around. And in sobriety, had to go back to see what I missed. And I did. But I didn't understand that I was missing something. And I knew I wasn't fitting in, but I just kept drinking to anesthetize. And when my parents divorced, I just couldn't relate. And then my mom got real sick, and she had cancer, and she went through four bouts of different cancers within 4 years. And I was working for this airline, and I had a layover in Honolulu, Hawaii for 3 days. And the company called me and said, "Would you like to move to Saudi Arabia?" And I went, "Nah, I don't think so. I'm going to stay right here," because they were ceasing operations in New York and moving them to Saudi Arabia. And I went, "Nah, send my unemployment check right here to Honolulu." And they proceeded to do that, and I stayed in Hawaii, and then my mom called me and told me that she was told she was terminal. So I went back to be with her through her death, and I stayed with her, and of course, you know, when they say 2 weeks, it goes on and on and on, so I just stayed with her, and I said, "Ma, look, you're not going to have to go back to work. Let's go to Hawaii. You know, you got nothing else to do." And she didn't want to go, and I stayed with her, and I watched her die, and I can't explain how devastating it was, because I didn't realize then, because I anesthetized myself. I stayed drunk the entire experience. And I was giving her shots of synthetic pain medicine to keep her out of pain for 4 days, and then she finally passed on. And when she had passed away, I felt like something had changed in me, and I didn't know what it was. Now, I wasn't get sober. I couldn't see that the drinking was escalating and everything else around me was getting worse. I thought it was the world. I thought this was all messed up. It was all New York's fault. New York's getting polluted, New York, you know, so let's just go back to Hawaii. And I went back there, and I couldn't feel a thing. I was immobilized in emotional pain, so I drank and I drank and I drank. And then 9 months later, my sister called me from here and said, "Dad died." And I went, "What?" You know, and it didn't hit me. And I couldn't get back in time for him to be buried in their divorce, it was many years later, he had married a woman who wanted to have him buried, or actually cremated, within 24 hours, and I couldn't get back in time for it. And I couldn't relate to it. And I came home, I came back here, I couldn't feel anything. And I went back to Hawaii, and I just stood there, and I was like, I couldn't feel the beauty anymore. I couldn't see the beauty in the environment. I couldn't surf anymore. I couldn't do anything and feel the beauty. I was numb, no matter what. I couldn't drink anymore to get any number. The alcohol wasn't working anymore. So I came back here to New York to try and help my sister out with everything that, you know, all the estate stuff that's left behind and Point Lookout. And I didn't want to be in Point Lookout because all the memories were flooding back. But we stayed there, and she and I worked it out, and we just drank our way all the way through the whole thing. That's how we dealt with it. And I knew there had to be a change in my life. So I took a man hostage and married him, and you know, he drank more than I did. So this was great. He was going to keep me really anesthetized, and he did. And then all of a sudden something was missing, so of course I had to have a child, and that was going to fix everything. And God bless, though, I do have a beautiful child today. He's 19 years old, and he's a big, beautiful child. But that wasn't pulling anything together inside of me. And then someone suggested that I go to a 12-step program. And I was like, what? And a therapist had said to me, I had a lot of isms. She didn't say to me I was an alcoholic. She was so gentle with me, thank God, because I was a brat. You told me I had something wrong with me, or you told me yes, I went no. You said black, I went white. It was just, I was such a, you know, a horror child, and I went against everything. Well, this marriage didn't work, of course, because I was a mess. So the next thing is divorce, you know. So I divorced him, and now I'm raising a child by myself, and I'm going back to work waitressing. I'm doing the whole circle all over again, and I'm drinking and anesthetizing. Well, when I had my son, I was sober through the entire, you know, you're real healthy. And I'll backtrack a little bit. I'm a runner. I love to jog, and I got into health after my mom passed away, because when I watched her go through that, I just said, that's it. I'm not eating red meat. I am not doing this. I'm not doing that. I became a vegetarian. Everything was to change my life after watching her go through that, and I became a jogger, and I'm, you know, why not? I'm a runner, and I'm running, and that is, I was using it as another means to feel better. I was using anything I could to feel better. And I didn't say this, but when I was 17 years old, to escape again, I decided to go to India and find a guru. And I went, and I did find a guru, and he was great, and he taught me how to meditate, and today I am grateful for that. But I thought if I did that, you know, I didn't shave my hair, but I was that close to it, and wear the saffron robes, and try, you know, I thought that was the answer. Because I couldn't feel what the answer was. I couldn't get it intellectually. I couldn't get it anywhere. And so the guru thing was great, except that when I was there for 3 months, when I came back to the United States, something didn't jive. I couldn't fit in both worlds. It wasn't clicking. There was no balance there. So meditation, alcohol, meditation lost. And alcohol kicked in real big. I kept meditating, but I found you can't meditate when you're drunk. It don't work. I tried, and let me tell you, I tried. It just doesn't work. And so through the years, I'm like meditating and then going over here, and then I'm still traveling all over the world. And, you know, with my son, he calmed me down. He grounded me immediately. I stopped the drinking and the drugging and blah, blah, blah. And then when he was 6 years old, I went, just a little glass of red wine. I didn't see how fast that red wine glass becomes bottles and then becomes cases. I didn't see it because now I'm drinking alone. I'm not letting anyone come with me. And so I was hanging out in a restaurant, and one of the girls decided that she's going to try and help me, and she brought me to a meeting. And in the interim, I have now divorced. I met this gentleman who was the owner of a bar. That was God to me, you know. He was the mayor of the city. He owned the bar. Everybody knew him. And we got together, and it was a volatile relationship. It was like a stick of dynamite, and I was the match, or vice versa. I love to fight. I get power from fighting, from arguments, and we used to do that real well with a glass of wine or Grand Marnier or whatever. And so it was a great relationship. And we went back and forth and back and forth. And then we went off for a little while, and I came into the rooms of AA. All my friends that were drinking were gone. I couldn't find them anymore. And I walked into the Serenity by the Sea in Long Beach, and lo and behold, there were all the girls and guys that I used to drink with. And so I sat down, and I was so angry, and I sat like this, way in the back of the room, and somebody asked me, are you angry? I went, no, I'm not angry. And they asked me if I thought I was an alcoholic. No, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm here because I have a lot of isms, you know. And slowly but surely, I totally related to every story and everybody who got up there and started speaking. I was like, wow. And this went from this one to this one to, oh, my God. And then I started sharing. And I started sharing my story. And then they said I had something to say. And through the sobriety, you know, I started working the steps and got a sponsor and working the program. I started feeling again. It was, I had lost my best friend, the bottle of wine, and I had a hard time in the beginning because every night at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when I wanted that glass of wine, I'd call my sponsor. Every day that I wanted that alcohol, I would call somebody. I started working the program. My boyfriend, who I was seeing, he had gotten sober, and he came over to my house, and he made an amends to me, and I was floored. I never thought I heard the word God come out of his mouth. It just was the last thing, and wow. It all made, oh, wow, God, something spiritual, ooh, okay. And I accepted his amends, of course, and then I watched him change, and I watched all my friends change. And we started talking again, and he was talking about the program, and I was talking about the program, and all of a sudden the relationship started jiving. And we got married. And what happened was in early sobriety, my husband got real sick, and he had to have a liver transplant. And they had told us, we came into the city, and we were shopping for hospitals and doctors, and, you know, we found out all the damage that was done, and that transplant would be the next step. And so they told us about the live donor program and asked us if we knew anyone in the family who might step up, and my hand went up like this. I'm like, oh my God, who put that up there? I had no idea how I'd done that. And I found out about it, and we found out we had the same blood type. We had the same skin type in the grafting, and we took a lot of tests, and they said, well, when do you want to do it? And we made the date for July 1st, 2002. It was like a cesarean. Man, you planned the whole thing. It was great. And I asked my son first. I wanted to know how he felt about it. He was the only person I was really concerned about, because my ex-husband had me dead and buried already. And all my friends, of course, in AA were so supportive. I remember the first day I was sitting in the meeting, and I said, I'm going to give half my liver to my husband. And everyone just turned around. And I had no idea who was talking through me. It was just such a spiritual awakening. And we went to the hospital. My son said, yeah, I think it'd be really cool. You'll have this little cool, you know, he was 15, a cool scar on your stomach like a samurai sword. I said, okay, if it's okay with you, then I knew. And I'd asked many people in the world. I'd asked doctors, lawyers, priests, cops, anybody. I wanted the answer. I wanted someone to say, yeah, it's okay. But it was the rooms of AA that kept saying, yeah, yeah, it's okay. And then in my heart, I knew it was okay, and I had a conversation with God the night before. And on July 2nd, we walked into the hospital, and a good friend of us drove us in there, and we walked in there, and we were only supposed to have two people each in the pre-op, and we had 12. We had all our friends were there from the program who had come in to support us, and the minister, and then the surgeons came in, and the anesthesiologist, and they came, and we all held hands, and we said the serenity prayer. And I walked into one room, and he walked into another room. And I woke up 7 hours later, I believe it was, and Bill Tater was sitting over me, and I went, oh, God, am I alive? I wasn't sure, you know. You know, I don't know if anybody knows what he does for a living, but I just wanted to make sure. Okay, I'm in the right place, right? He proceeded with my sponsor, my girlfriend Lee, to take care of me with the doctors and the nurses. And it was such an incredible experience. And then I went up to my room. They wheeled me up to my room, and I was wondering where my husband was, and they said, he's okay. I went, okay, it worked. By the grace of God, it worked. And he's had a lot of stuff happen to him since then. He had to have the operation twice. My husband doesn't do things once. He does things in two, and he doesn't get away with it. And he's had a lot since then. The immunosuppressant drugs that they give you after transplant are very tough drugs. They're rough on the body. You've got to be in a real good place with God to get through this stuff. And he had a bout with cancer, a real bad one, and he got through that. And then he had a second bout with cancer. He got through that, and now he's got a new pacemaker. And he knows that hospital. It's near Presbyterian. We've been in every department and every floor, and we know them well. And But they take good care of us over there. And by the grace of God, we have an incredible experience. We have an incredible marriage. We have most incredible friends. Bill Tater put together a support group when we were doing the transplant of people to come over to the house every day because we couldn't move, you know. It feels like an elephant sitting on your stomach when you're going through that, when you wake up. And he made sure somebody was there with me 24 hours a day. You know, the people in AA came over and supported us. And I don't like to say this, but it's true. They were there for us more than our family was. And I love my family very much, and they were there the best that they could. You know, they do the best they can. They don't understand, unless they're in the program, what the love and support is in this program. This program is all about love and service and going out and telling everybody what you've been through and how you got through it. And it's only by the grace of God and this program and the people in this program and working these steps that you get through this stuff. And today, you know, I can't say enough about it. And I went to a big book seminar just last weekend up in Vermont at the Wilson House. And it just refreshes you what these steps are all about, what this program is all about, the miracle that God comes into your life and helps you through anything you're going through. You can get through it if you work the program. When I think of all the other stuff that I went through, and you think you can do it yourself, and then you just, it's about surrender, and surrender to this program and to God. It seems so hard, but it's the simplest thing I've ever done in my life. I have to do it on a daily basis. That's the thing I have to remember. Every morning I wake up, I thank God that I'm alive, especially after this transplant operation. I thank God for life, for my breath, for the AA program, for my family, my friends, for this program. It has given me such a new life, such a beautiful life. I can't even explain it. I went back to working for another airline, and I love it. I love flying. I'm out of my mind, but I just love it. You know, when I'm on that tiny little tube, I'm in there talking to people all the time. For the first time in my life, I'm not afraid of people. I'm not afraid to open up to them. It's not about the party anymore. It's about gathering together and sharing each other's love, hope, and strength, and everything that comes in between it, because it's not all a bowl of cherries. It's not all happy, happy, happy. But I've learned that all the hard stuff is helping me more than the beautiful stuff, because everything that's difficult, I rely more on this program for. I rely more on God for. That's what gets me through it. If things are good all the time, I get bored, you know? I just like, you know, but I got to be careful when I say that, because, you know, watch what you ask for and what you pray for. And I learned so much from my mistakes. Now, I used to be such a perfectionist. If I made a mistake, I'd freak, you know? God, they're not going to like me. You're not going to... Now I learn so much from every mistake I make that I embrace them. And they're coming at me, you know, one at a time. You know, I keep making mistakes, and that's okay. And I heard an expression just the other day where God, you know, this guy said, you never admit that you make mistakes. And this guy said, I keep making mistakes. And I admit to him, I keep making mistakes because one day I'm going to get it right. And that's how it is, you know. I embrace my mistakes, but I embrace this life. Because it's not just about being happy, joyous, free, you know, drug, sex, and rock and roll ain't happening. It's about helping one another get through it. Something magical happens when you look into someone's eye who's really hurting and you go, it's okay, you're going to be okay. You put your arm and you hug them. You give them a big hug. I'm not afraid to hug anybody anymore, and I'm not afraid for anybody to hug me. That was a big thing. I was afraid to get close to people for a real long time, and I'm not afraid of that anymore. I embrace people. There are moments when I go into my little, you know, cocoon and I'm having a hard time, and in those moments is when I get on my knees and I thank God and I pray to God for more strength to get through whatever I got to get through. And there's always going to be more with my husband. He is a Pandora box. There's always something. He's never a dull moment. There's always something coming up. And in all life, that's why I go to a meeting every morning. I want to see what's going on with my sponsees, my sponsor, and all the people that are coming in, all the newcomers, man. This is a great trip. This is a great journey. The path, it's wide. It's very, very wide. And we're all coming in different ways, but we're all going to the same place. And my higher power is what it's all about for me. I love this program. I love the people in it. Thank you, Helen, so much for asking me to speak. I'm really grateful for being here. And thank you very much.